Chapter 27. Trial began on Monday, the first week of April, on a windswept day that alternated between blowing snow and freezing rain. The snow was light and seemed more a protest than a serious event. The freezing rain came and went, but never did form ice on the windows or windshields. Thaddeus was getting around with only a cane now, but he still wore the holstered gun under his coat. Morning until night. He kept it beside his recliner while he watched TV and read at night. He kept it on his bedside table. It was always loaded and ready to be fired in an instant. The deputies at the courthouse knew all about the arrangement, so they waved him through security without a question. Judge Prelate had made it very clear to them Thaddeus could come and go at will with his gun under his coat. It was an exception to the general rule that no civilian could enter the courthouse while possessing a firearm. The weather reminded Thaddeus of what he was up against. Snow or freezing rain. Guilty or not guilty. With his cane, he made it to the courtroom. Christine was close behind. She pulled a wheeled briefcase jammed with papers and pads and books on evidence. His stomach was cramped and he needed to urinate. There was a constant feeling in his bowels of an impending explosion, but so far nothing. He knew from law school exams and the bar exam the feeling of helpless fear, and that's what he was feeling now. It was a feeling that you had done all you could to prepare, but you knew going in that even your best efforts weren't going to be good enough. Happily enough, he had made it through law school and had only had to sit for the bar exam one time. But this was his first jury trial, and this time there were no study groups, no cram courses, no memorization techniques, no hints from others who had been there before. Plus, he knew they could prove Ermeline guilty beyond a reasonable doubt without breaking much of a sweat on their side. He felt totally isolated from the world, and would have traded everything he had at that moment to be waiting patiently beside a cash register for the first customer of the day in his office supply store, never knowing the feelings he was having just now. This was a terror they didn't tell you about in law school, and how could they really? He imagined that it was the same sort of terror soldiers must feel before a battle. You had done all you could to prepare, but there was always the possibility you weren't going to make it out alive. That was exactly how he was feeling when a sudden still fell over the courtroom. The air was filled with expectancy. Someone had seen something. At just that moment, at 9 a.m., Judge Prelate's court reporter entered the courtroom from the judge's chambers. By now, the small auditorium was filled to overflowing with jury candidates, bystanders, and press. Several deputies milled around up front, inside the bar where only the attorneys and court officials were allowed, like they owned the place. When the court reporter entered, they scattered, most of them exiting the courtroom altogether. But their presence hadn't gone unnoticed. They had been telling the crowd, "This place belongs to us, belongs to law and order." Thaddeus furiously limped into the fenced area and made a big show of claiming the defense table. He irately laid out books and papers from one side of the table to the other and made a big production of walking around the table and claiming that space as his and his alone. At 9:05, Deputy Harshman accompanied Ermeline to the table, and she took her seat beside him. Behind counsel table, but in front of the bar, was a wide roll of upholstered captain's chairs for the attorneys while they waited their turn at the tables. Deputy Harshman helped himself to one of those chairs directly behind Ermeline. He was letting everyone know that he was in charge of her, that she was in his custody, even though she was sitting up front with her lawyer. Rulanda Barr entered moments later with Sheriff Altman at her side. The sheriff was the chief investigator and would represent the law enforcement arm of the state. Thus, he would be sitting beside SAAG Barr at counsel table. She had very few books with her, just a laptop and an Illinois evidence manual. Three legal pads were scattered on the table before her. Then the judge entered, and all eyes looked his way. With the flourish of robes and his large stride, he took the bench, overlooking the sea of faces.
"Thank you," said Judge Prelate, as total quiet settled over the full house. "Please be seated."
The judge nodded to the bailiff, Don Helsinger, who called court to order.
"Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. The circuit court for the judicial circuit is now in session. The Honorable Nathan R. Prelate, judge, presiding."
"Thank you," said Judge Prelate.
He surveyed counsel table and appeared satisfied with the arrangements.
"Counsel,"
he began slowly,
"are there any pre-trial matters you need to have the court take up before we begin jury selection?"
"No, Your Honor," said Rulanda Barr,
quickly on her feet and looking as serious as one might look just before an execution.
"No, Your Honor," said Thaddeus, who gamely pulled himself upright and stood,
one shoulder higher than the other. He wished there was something he had to bring up that might change this terrible downhill slope he was looking at. But he knew there was nothing he could think of, no last-minute tactic to spring. So he took his seat. Ermeline exhaled beside him, and he could feel her counting on him every minute they sat there.
"Very well. Ladies and gentlemen, I will now ask the clerk to select a jury panel by lot."
The clerk proceeded to draw names by chance, and as those names were called, the prospective jurors took their seats in the jury box according to the number they were called. Then the judge continued.
"Those of you who are appearing today pursuant to a jury summons, you have been summoned as a prospective juror in the circuit court to render interesting and important evidence. Your name was drawn by lot from the combined lists of registered voters, unemployment claimants, licensed drivers, holders of Illinois identification cards, and Illinois disabled person identification cards who reside in this county. All of those so drawn constitute the group from which jurors will be selected to hear particular cases."
Thaddeus looked at the faces in the jury box. Some he knew, most he didn't know. But counsel had been provided with background sheets on the entire jury panel, consisting of several sentences on each person who had to appear that day. He had gone over the list with Christine before court. He had gone over the list with Quentin. Last night he had gone over the list with Eileen. He felt he knew more about the panel than SAAG Barr would ever know. Some of what he knew was very helpful. Most was not. He began comparing names in the jury box to names on the information sheets. Ermeline read along with him as he underlined certain factual information with his finger. "Interesting," he whispered to her as they went quickly through the names. The court then launched into the standard jury questions: name, age, address, marital status, business, occupation or profession, children, know any of the parties, know any law enforcement officials, and on and on. Then came the moment both attorneys had been pawing the ground and waiting for, the chance to ask the jurors questions themselves. Rolanda Barr went first.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she began, and an elderly gentleman in the back row immediately waved his hand.
"Present,"
he said weakly.
"Have any of you heard anything about this case?"
she asked, ignoring the elderly man. He sat up.
"Can't say I have. Of course, I don't keep up much anymore."
She let her eyes rest on him.
"Did any of you know Victor Harrow?"
"Who?"
the gentleman asked, as if she were speaking to him and him alone.
"Victor Harrow, the decedent."
"I don't know any decedent, no."
"The man who was murdered, did you know him?"
"No, I don't know anyone who's been murdered."
She looked frustrated and was working hard to maintain patience.
"Let me ask something, and I want you to know I'm not prying here, Mr.—"
She found his name on her jury map.
"Mr. Boticus, do you have difficulty hearing me?"
"Not a bit. I can hear a pin drop."
"It just seemed like you weren't following my questions, that's all."
"I don't follow your questions all that well. I'm not a well man."
"And without being specific, what is the nature of your illness?"
"Well, they tell me it's called early-onset senile dementia."
Judge Prelate extended both hands across the high desk and motioned the attorneys to approach him. He whispered,
"Counsel, I'm going to excuse Mr. Boticus for cause. Any objection?"
"No, Your Honor," both attorneys said in unison. After Mr. Boticus had stepped down, his seat was taken by a young woman with freckles. She looked to be early 30s and was alert. SAAG Barr continued with her questions. She asked about feelings about jury service, whether anyone had any opinions about the case, whether anyone had any strong feelings about homicide cases, whether anyone had any strong feelings or opinions about the death penalty. A few hands went up now and then, but on this last question she got 6 responses, 3 of them waving dramatically to be heard.
"All right," she said. "I'm going to ask each one of you individually. If you sat as a juror in this case and heard all the evidence, and you believe the defendant was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, would you have any hesitation in voting guilty only because you knew the death chamber was a possible result for this defendant?"
"Objection," said Thaddeus, taking his feet, attempting to pre-qualify the jury. Judge Prelate appeared thoughtful.
"I don't believe it's wholly inappropriate, Mr. Murphy, and I don't believe it's prejudicial. You may continue, Miss Barr."
"Would the clerk please read back the question?"
The clerk read the question again, and all eyes fastened on the juror who first had raised her hand.
"All right,"
said S.A.E.G. Barr. "Your name is Matilda Henna, and you're the mother of three teenage boys. How would you answer my question? Any hesitation in voting guilty simply because this might be a death penalty case?"
"I don't believe the Lord wants us to judge other people," she said, and looked at the other jurors and at the gallery for support.
Very few heads nodded agreement. She looked down.
"I just don't think we have the right to take anyone's life for any reason. Judge not that ye not be judged, and all. So, your religious conviction would prevent you from voting guilty, even if you believe the state had proved the defendant's guilt beyond reasonable doubt?"
"I wouldn't say it would prevent me," Matilda Henna said. "It just meant it would be difficult."
Great, thought Thaddeus. She's going to have to use one of her peremptory challenges to get rid of this lady. Inside, his heart lifted for joy, and he made a silent prayer of thanksgiving, though he wasn't sure he believed all that much himself. S.A.A.G. Barr persisted, coming at it from another direction.
"So you could vote guilty, even if you knew it might result in this defendant being sent to the execution chamber?"
"Objection," said Thaddeus, again taking his feet. "Counsel is attempting to get this witness to commit to promise. That's improper voir dire."
"Agree," said the judge. "Miss Henna, sometimes counsel will ask you questions, and I'll allow it. Sometimes I won't. This doesn't mean you've done anything wrong, but right now I'm going to instruct you that you don't have to answer counsel's last question."
Matilda Henna shook her head.
"But I won't to answer. I would need to seek guidance in prayer to make my vote. I can't just decide on my own."
Great, thought Thaddeus. You just made my jury.
S.A.A.G. Barr looked down at her notes. She moved along. "Ladies and gentlemen, only the person charged with the crime knows what happened to Victor Harrow. She might not even testify. Therefore, the state has no eyewitness testimony to offer. Knowing that this is a first-degree murder case, do you feel like you have to say to yourself, 'Well, the case is just too serious to decide based upon circumstantial evidence to a return of verdict of first-degree murder'?"
Thaddeus felt he ought to object to this question, but he couldn't formulate exactly what his objection would be, so he decided to keep still. Along with the others in the courtroom, he waited for any hands to go up. None did, so S.A.A.G. Barr finally nodded and made her notes. Thaddeus made a note himself. He might like to come back to this when it was his turn. She went again.
"Is there anyone who just can't sit on a capital murder case, meaning a case that might result in the death penalty?"
Thaddeus shot to his feet.
"Objection! Asked and answered!"
Judge Prelate nodded.
"Counsel," he said to Attorney Barr, "you've heard from the jury on the issue of willingness to convict in a capital case. Please move along."
She tried again, but this time slightly different.
"Now, everyone on the jury is in favor of capital punishment for this offense. Is there anyone on the jury, because the nature of the offense feels like you might be a little bit biased or prejudiced, either consciously or unconsciously, because of the type or the nature of the offense involved? Is there anyone on the jury who feels they would be in favor of a sentence other than death for homicide?"
A hand went up and back.
"Miss Henna?"
"Great," thought Thaddeus. "Her again. Just please don't get yourself kicked off for a cause." He hoped and prayed she would remain on the jury. She was totally against the death penalty, and he knew that, and while it was enough to get her kicked off by the court itself, she hadn't, so far, actually come right out and said she wouldn't vote guilty on a death case. "Please don't say any more," he silently begged.
"I've thought it over some more," Matilda Henna said. "I could vote guilty on a death case."
"Gotcha," thought Thaddeus. "Thank you."
"All right, thank you, Miss Henna. Anyone who feels they might be in favor of a sentence other than death on a homicide case?"
Everyone looked at everyone else. No one else was going to bite. By now, the jurors had grown more than a little curious and more were interested in making it on the jury to see what it was all about. Plus, it appeared to be an important case, and who knows, maybe books would be written, maybe even by one of them. Any more, juries in the U.S. might as well have their own literary agents when they get selected to serve. They would need to be told about note-taking and keeping notes separate from the books the court passed out for notes, because those notes were always collected and destroyed at the end of trials. It was important to know these things. S.A.A.G. Barr plunged ahead, knowing Ermeline's reputation in the community was spotless.
"Would anyone consider, if you had the opportunity, evidence about this defendant, either good or bad, other than that arising from the incident itself?"
"Objection!"
said Thaddeus. Overly broad. Too general.
Sustained.
Let me rephrase. If the defendant's reputation in the community was generally good and the defendant had no prior record, would that affect how you might vote in the case, even if the state proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
Objection! Seeks to commit the jury to a certain vote. Improper.
Sustained. Counsel, please stay with standard voyeur dire.
There has been a good deal of local pretrial publicity about this. I know, my office has the clippings, and we've seen the Channel 5 news reports. Do you remember facts from any of those stories that would affect your partiality? Or could you set aside those stories and pay attention only to the facts adduced here in court?
Objection. First, it's multiple.
Sustained.
And second, it violates Moomin versus Virginia. The Constitution does not require the court to allow counsel to question the jurors about the contents of pretrial publicity to which they were maybe exposed. The appropriate question here is whether they have such fixed opinions they couldn't be impartial, not what they remember about the news stories.
He was happy with his objection. He had done his homework and knew a little more about voyeur dire than he had realized when he first walked in this morning. Maybe, just maybe.
Sustained. Anything further, Miss Barr?
She reviewed her notes, or at least appeared to review her notes. More than likely, she was trying to hide her embarrassment from having asked several improper questions, Thaddeus thought to himself. More than likely, she was trying to appear thoughtful and still in charge.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Very well. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take our noon recess. Please be back in your assigned seats at 1 o'clock sharp. Please remember the admonition the clerk has given you. Do not discuss the case with anyone, including with each other. Please refrain from all news accounts and TV stories about the case. If anyone approaches you and tries to discuss the case with you, please notify the court immediately. Thank you. You're excused until 1 p.m.
Thaddeus and Ermeline put their heads together for several minutes, and then Deputy Harshman took her back to the jail for lunch. Thaddeus hurried back over to his office. He had several ideas for voyeur dire that he wanted to map out for when it came his turn at 1 o'clock.